Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas. Death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are being made at this moment to execute former truck driver Terry Kerr by injecting him with massive dosages of drugs normally used to save lives. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the state killing of Terry Kerr, whose capital conviction and 10-year stay on death row cost Texas taxpayers more than three times what it would have cost them to put him away for life. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Professor Denise Longmire, Houston digital reporter Dave Atwood, and special interview guest Nicole Conceras, whose 8-year investigation helped free a man wrongly convicted and imprisoned on death row for more than 12 years. The Execution Watch begins.
And this is Ray Hill. You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston. This is Execution Watch, the program that we do not want to do. We are loath to do this program because when this program comes on the air, it means someone is being executed in the death chamber in Huntsville. We've been doing this for several years. I will have later in the show legal analyst Jim Skelton, a former criminal defense lawyer and former prosecutor in Harris County with extensive trial experience. We will bring in Nicole Caceres. And Nicole is a professor. Caceres. Nicole Caceres, and Nicole is a professor of journalism and media and law at the University of St. Thomas. Dennis Longmire is the first voice we'll bring into the studio besides mine. Dennis, you're on the air. Hello. Here he is. Yeah, I got you, Dennis. You're on the air. What's going on there?
Well, all of the witnesses have entered the Walls unit. There are about a dozen of us out here on the corner standing in opposition to tonight's execution. We hear that there is also a group of people on the other corner that we cannot see who are here celebrating this execution. They are here in support of it. It's a very, very sad night, a very, very sad moment for a lot of people here. There are several people here from Switzerland who are visiting men on death row. There's a woman with her daughter here from St. Louis who has been corresponding with Kerry since he's been on death row. And so it's not a happy moment for anyone.
Of the witnesses, were there representatives of Mr. Kerr's family?
Well, apparently his sister is one of the witnesses. Also, a pen pal that he has been corresponding with from Germany went in, and then there were, I think, three lawyers. I saw Brad Levinson as one of them that went in. One of the women here who has been corresponding with Kerry was supposed to be on his witness list, but Kerry had not completed the form properly, so they would not allow him to modify the form at the last minute, so she was not able to go in to witness. But we were told by someone here that one of the women who was a very good friend of the victim of this crime came in at the last minute, and she has been allowed to go in to witness the execution on behalf of the victim's families. And so
we got,
obviously, once again, different standards for different sides of the issue.
Yeah, that's that is frequently not a surprise in this business. Dennis, we appreciate you very much. Give our regards to the other folks gathered there, and let us know when something else happens.
I will do that.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you, sir. And that was Professor Dennis Longmire. He is a professor at Sam Houston State University, and he is a frequent vigilant at Execution Watch. What happens, or what was in that message, was that Dennis informed us that the witnesses had crossed the street. In execution lingo, that means that the process has begun. The first thing that happens is the media goes across the street in a group, and immediately following them, the witnesses for the person scheduled to be executed are taken across the street. They've been inside the former administration building across the street from the walls in Huntsville, and now they have gone inside, which means that the process has begun. About 6:20 or 6:25, they will return from that building, and we will know then that the execution has been completed. And I think that I'm going to do things a little out of order, Jim. I'm going to put Dave on and find out what's going on at the Houston vigil. Dave, are you there?
I'm here, Ray.
What's going on where you are?
Well, we're at the corner of Shepherd and Westheimer, right out in front of St. Anne's Church. And we've got a really good turnout today for us here. We've got 16 people.
That's an except they got about a dozen people in Huntsville.
Yeah, we got 16 here. We got some people from out of town. And we've got a number of people here that I don't even know who they are. That's always a good sign when new people show up. And but really, we've got this is an extremely busy corner, both on Shepherd and on Westheimer, sure. And so a lot of people see us.
And you've even got motorcycles, I can tell.
Yeah, you can hear the motorcycle, right.
So. Dave, this is something a little bit unusual. Apparently, according to Dennis, who is our reporter from Huntsville, there is a pro-execution demonstration going on about a block from the anti-execution demonstration, and that is unusual for this kind of case.
Yes, yes, it is. The pro-death penalty people don't normally come out unless it's a police officer.
Unless it's a law enforcement officer of some kind.
Right. And so that is unusual. I'm sort of surprised.
I'm surprised about that. Maybe Dennis will have some more information when we go back to them. Well, Dave, I appreciate your calling and give that report. Could you tell us just briefly about your organization?
Well, people out here are, for the most part, Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty people from the Houston area. And there's actually two sisters that are here that have a brother on death row also. They're members of the Texas Coalition, and then we've got it's just a good diverse group of people, some Amnesty International people, some people from the church here, and then some people I don't even know who they are, but it's just a good variety of people.
Thank you very much, Dave. We'll let you know when we get word.
Okay, thank you, Ray.
Thank you, sir. And that was Dave Atwood, and Dave Atwood is one of the founders of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty and a frequent voice and a constant vigilant on the occasion of executions, sometimes here, sometimes elsewhere, but always on the picket line somewhere. Well, with us, of course, is Jim Skelton. Jim is a legal educator. He's a former practicing attorney. He has been on both sides of the bar. He's practiced as a prosecutor and a defense lawyer. Jim, you look into this case?
Sure did.
What happened?
Basically what occurred, there was a woman by the name of Pamela Horton that was at a bar in Fort Worth, and she's with a friend named Jennifer York, and this gentleman by the name of Carrie Kerr was also at the bar. And apparently Carrie Kerr and this lady Pamela Horton had been seen together, off and on together, for about a month. She apparently had another boyfriend, was kind of seeing him on the side. And what happened, Pamela Horton got extremely drunk, and she wanted to go home, and her friend Jennifer didn't want to take her. So at that point, Carrie Kerr agreed to take her home. And what's a little bit confusing about the case is there's no time that they give in the record when they left the bar. But several people saw Carrie Kerr leave the bar with Pamela Horton. And the intention was to take her home. And he went back in the bar after he went outside with her in the parking lot and came back and told another female friend, "I'm taking this drunk bitch home and then I'll be back." So what happened, we don't know what time they left the bar. That's never established in the record. The next thing that happened is they find Pamela Horton at 2 o'clock in the morning laying on the street, unconscious, well, dead. And all she's wearing is a pair of shorts. Her shirt's off, her shoes are off, no underwear on. And so what happens, a taxi cab driver sees her, and he calls the paramedics, and the paramedics come out to the scene.
She's laying in the road.
Laying right in the middle of the road. And like I say, she is only clad in a pair of shorts, no underwear, no shirt, no shoes, nothing else. And when she, the paramedics apparently oftentimes will cover the body to keep people from staring. And when they did, Carrie Kerr walks up and said, "Can you let me look at the body? I may be able to identify her. I may know who she is." And they said, "No, you can't do it. And what do you know about this?" And then he kind of hem-hawed and explained that he was the one that called the paramedics. And they said, no. A taxi cab driver told us. And he said, "Well, I call the cab driver." And here's what he basically said to the paramedics and led when the police arrived. That he had gone to the store and on the way home from the store saw this woman laying out in the street. And there was a parked car nearby, and he thought it was a setup for a robbery to get him to stop. And then he claimed he called 911, but there's no record that he ever did that. So when the police arrived, they began to question him, and what really drew their interest is that Pamela Horton was blonde-headed, and there was a piece of blonde hair on Carrie Kerr's face. But interesting enough, at least from reading the opinions, there's no sign of him hitting anybody, nothing by the way of what we call aggressive wounds, no bruises on his fist, nothing like this.
And everybody was drunk.
Yeah, real drunk.
Everybody was.
In fact, Pamela Horton had .46, and at that point, if you're not a big drinker, you're supposed to be dead. Because it's like 4.5 times the legal limit.
That's what college kids die of, is that kind of alcohol.
Exactly.
Content.
I mean, he was apparently just as drunk as she was. And so at this point, the police began to question him. They were concerned about the blonde hair, because he didn't have blonde hair. Pamela Horton did. And then inside of his car, they saw a purse. And he asked her about the purse. She said, "Well, it probably belongs to that lady," meaning Pamela Horton. And on the purse was a hair clasp that women oftentimes use to pull their hair back.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the evidence, there were like 14 teeth when that was originally made, and 8 of them had been knocked out. Plus, the spring had been broken, and the evidence showed that it took quite a blow to not cause all this damage. They end up arresting him that night for the murder. And then they go to his home with a search warrant, and while at the home, they find the following. They find some of the teeth out of the broken comb, and they were able to connect the teeth from the home to the comb they found on the purse inside the car. They found Pamela Horton underwear, brassiere, and her brassiere had been ripped. One of the shoulder straps was ripped off, and apparently one of the cups had been ripped loose, and her DNA was on that. And what happened, they then did DNA testing, and they found the semen. By DNA testing, they found Carrie Kerr's semen in Pamela Horton's mouth. And so what they did is they charged him with murder during the course of committing aggravated rape. And aggravated rape, you know, includes forcing sure. somebody to have sex. And that was the theory behind the death penalty. And that's how they sought the death penalty, was that. And the major thrust of the defense from reading the opinions was that it was consensual sex, and that if it is consensual sex, that is not murder committed during the course of consensual sex.
What was the cause of death?
Strangulation. Because what happened, it indicated, when you look at the medical evidence, the physical evidence, she had a bruise on her head, a bruise above her breast, and that bone, when you angle, the hyphoid bone is what it's called,
sure.
that was broken. And so she died of manual strangulation.
So that's not object down the throat. That's
right.
That is a strangulation, like hands on the neck.
Exactly. And so they claim there were two types of wounds, and wounds that were inflicted before she died and afterwards. And apparently the wounds conflicted after were consistent with somebody being thrown out of a car. So the state's theory was that he had forcible sex with this woman, got angry, strangled her to death to cover up the sexual event because she didn't like it, and then took her body out and threw it out on the highways. That was the theory. And what's interesting, this man at the time that he committed the offense was like 37 years old. He wasn't a youngster, and he had, except for misdemeanors, a few misdemeanors like DWIs and things of that nature, no prior criminal record. And it took the jury something like 6 hours to find him guilty of capital murder because they didn't buy the consensual sex part. And what happened, the punishment hearing primarily, and this should draw a shudder down everyone's neck, primarily consisted of two former ex-wives that came in and testified against him and a former girlfriend. And their testimony was pretty consistent. The ex-wives claimed that he would beat them up and he was abusive to them. That he would get drunk. When he got drunk, he got violent. Of course, he was drunk that night, which lends to the violence. What really hurt him, then also there was a girlfriend that testified. He had two ex-wives and an ex-girlfriend. And the girlfriend was the one that said during the time she dated him, whenever he drank, he got violent. She disagreed with him. He'd hit her and strike her. And apparently during their relationship, she had several protective orders issued against him to keep him from assaulting her. What really, really hurt him, though, he was babysitting a house, and the next-door neighbor came in, and he invited the next-door neighbor, a woman, of course, to come over and go swimming with him, and the neighbor agreed to do so. When he gets her in the pool, she tries to get out, and he pulls her back, and then at that point, she tries to get out, and he grabs her and pulls her back. He demands that she have oral sex with him. She refuses to do so. At that point, he said, "I want to see your breast," and he ripped the bra off her and her shirt or her swimming top off. And then he held her underwater like he was going to drown her. And then he said she told anybody that he'd killed her and dump her in the lake. And what really hurt was that was pretty much a signature offense.
Yeah, that's an upcoming element.
That's right. And that's probably what hurt him as much as anything, that was what we call a signature crime.
But is there any indication they were that drunk on the swimming pool thing?
They didn't say anything about it. What was interesting about that, Ray, and this amazed me because Larry Douglas and I were talking about that, he ended up pleading on a misdemeanor assault. And so apparently the DA's office in Fort Worth didn't take it very seriously because this was really, you know, an attempted sexual assault. Mm-hmm. That was reduced down to a misdemeanor. He did a year in the county on it. And that was somewhat amazing because that indicates the state wasn't really proud of the case, which indicates probably they might very well have been drunk when all of this transpired. And that was basically it, punishment. And the big flap on the direct appeal was, he got a psychologist, a defense lawyer did, got a psychologist to examine him and came up with this deal. There's only a 2% possibility he'd commit future dangerous acts in the future. And the defense lawyer tried to argue that 2% doesn't equate to his probability of him being a danger in the future.
Well, let's talk about how the case went. Any indication of how quality of legal representation you received?
I was impressed with the post-conviction writ. It's hard to tell if you don't know the trial that might have been overlooked. The thing that was overlooked at the trial level, there was no evidence that was later brought up in some federal writs about his childhood. Because as you well know, after the famous Penry case, if somebody comes from a very abusive background, if somebody's been abused as a child, that evidence can be used to mitigate punishment, and the jury cannot hold him as accountable as they would somebody else who had a kind of a normal childhood. And they kind of give him not a free ride, but they kind of give him a free pass. And if the jury finds that he had some horrible things happen to him as a child that he had no control over, that may mitigate it, and they would reduce the sentence. They reduce the sentence from death to life. And apparently none of this was presented at the trial level, because that was one of the issues later on at RIP. But yet, when you try to find out what that mitigating evidence was, there's nothing there. You go to all these websites looking for that mitigating evidence and never tell you what it is. And the fact is they had a deprived childhood.
The criminal defense lawyer may not have had access to any evidence to sustain that sort of thing.
Well, let me tell you what, I question that, because the new emphasis now on ineffective assistance to counsel is not mistakes made by counsel, but lack of preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't forgive that very easily. The Supreme Court, about 10 years ago, started reversing a bunch of cases where lawyers just simply didn't prepare. The most famous one involved some lawyers who there was an extraneous murder introduced, and evidence that extraneous murder had been set in the district clerk's office for a year, and the lawyers never looked at the file.
Mm.
And so what they did, they reversed it, not for what the lawyer did, but what he didn't do. And you have to kind of be careful, and we've talked about that, and even the judges have talked about this on the Supreme Court. One of the problems, if you prove that somebody has a personality defect because of the way he's treated as a child,
mm-hmm.
the backside of that is also an emphasis to execute him, because you can't fix that bad childhood.
Mm.
And so that cuts two ways, and it's kind of a delicate line to cross on how much mitigating evidence you introduced about a tragic childhood. Because the truth of the matter is, like in Penry's case, Penry was retarded. And when you get some kid who's been retarded, who's been terribly, terribly abused as a child, like in Penry's case, they burned him with cigarettes, locked him up in a chicken coop. He was sexually assaulted in prison. Horrible things happened to him. And the fear is among jurors, if that's happened to somebody, he's not going to get any better. And it's that old argument, you got to kill the dog to protect the sheep. So it can cut two ways. But nonetheless, the two big issues, at least on the federal writs, have been lack of mitigating evidence presented by the defense and the fact they're now using phenobarbital as one of the lethal mixtures in the drugs they use to execute somebody.
Why didn't that rise to the level of an issue in this case?
Supreme Court just wouldn't buy it. They've already answered once before on the, what we call, I hate to use that phrase, the cocktail they use to execute somebody. They've already decided that the chemicals used by the state were not cruel and unusual, didn't cause excessive pain. And phenobarbital is substituted for one of the drugs, and that went to the Supreme Court today, and they turned it down. I don't have any idea. I haven't seen the opinion. That's why they turned that down.
Has that worked in other states?
No.
It hasn't worked at
all?
It
hasn't worked at all.
Hasn't worked at all. Can you compare and contrast the two chemicals is what's out there?
I'm not familiar with the one they use that they used earlier that they're out of, but phenobarbital is a pretty common chemical, pretty common drug they use. I think they use it to control epilepsy, if I'm not mistaken. And that's a pretty common drug that we're all pretty well used to. Phenobarbital I'm familiar with. The drug it substitutes I'm not familiar with.
Okay, all I know about the drug it substitute is that I have read reports that it's pretty massive stuff and significantly more. You would have to take a lot of phenobarbital to do the same thing.
Well, sure, because people use it all
the
time.
Yeah, the whole purpose of doing the primary chemical is to... Dennis is calling in. Let's get... presumably bad news. Dennis, you're on the air.
Thank you for getting me back on. I'm sorry to say that everything is now over. All of the witnesses have come out of the Walls unit, and from everything we can tell, things probably went off without a hitch.
All that's left is for the reporters to go compose their stories.
Well, my sense is that most of them have already written their stories. Now they're just going to go file them. Of course, tonight is a bit different. I did hear you guys talking a little bit about the new protocol, the new use of the new drug, and so I'm
Can you shed some light on that?
Well, I didn't see it, and I don't know what happened. But I was going to say I suspect there will be something unique in tonight's story because it will be speaking about that particular issue. From my perspective, that's all distracting us from the real issue. And whether we use that drug or any other drug, we're still doing the wrong thing. So.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of concurrence with that. But what occurs to me is that drugs number 2 and 3 go absolutely devour your organs. And whatever they give you as the initial sedative is supposed to put you unconscious to the level that you do not feel that internal attack. And when you change that first chemical, you can knock somebody out. Their eyes can be closed.
Right.
They're not able to move, but they can still feel that excruciating pain of an assault on their internal organs. And that's the issue here.
Absolutely. And we will never know the answer to that question. I simply pray that everything went off without a hitch and that Kerry is now released from the suffering and the pain that we've been putting him through for the last 10 years or however long he's been on death row. Because one of the things we can't forget is that the men and women, but most particularly I know the men on death row right now are in torturous conditions. They are in absolute torture. And when I get to the corner, one of the songs that starts playing in the back of my mind is Bob Dylan's I Shall Be Released. Because no matter what happens right now, Kerry is in a better place. Kerry Kerr is no longer being tortured by the state of Texas. He's been released.
Dennis Longmire, that is very well put. I'm sorry I missed you. I was up doing Jerry Bruce's classes earlier this week.
And well, I hope he paid you well.
Sam doesn't pay anybody anything.
Oh, well, you need to get on the other side of that one.
Yeah, I need to work on that. I'll talk to Jerry about it. Next time I come up, we'll have to coffee up, Dennis.
Give me a call.
Thank you so much. And that was Dennis Longmire. And Dennis has... he teaches criminal justice at Sam Houston State University, and that is the nucleus of Texas prison system right there. I'm still not going to let go of this chemical thing because those folks that are executed are tortured on a daily basis. They're trying hunger strikes and all that, trying to solve it. And let me tell you, if you're on death row and you go on a hunger strike, who cares?
That's the problem.
That's the problem. Who cares? Yeah, hunger strikes work for Mahatma Gandhi. There's some more time reserved for us a little later, Jim. And so we may get into some philosophical points or look at the appellate process of on here what happened. But the professor is, the other professor is here. And Nicole Caceres, right?
Caceres, huh?
Caceres. Right, all right, I'm getting closer. The last time you were on, I jumbled your name pretty badly, too. You're a professor of journalism at the University of St. Thomas. You had somewhat famously used your students that I saw recently in a documentary about helping expose the wrongful conviction of Anthony Graves.
Right.
Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you so much.
And you have, do you know anything about this case, or you want to talk about your experience with Mr. Graves' case? You know, of course, you're on execution watch. You've been here before, so this is pretty much open format.
I'm not familiar with this case, so, but I will be happy to talk about Anthony's case or tell you what I know about death row conditions from Anthony or the status of what he's trying to do with respect to his compensation.
Well, when Anthony got out and when he came by the radio station, he's been here for the prison show and all that, and I listened very intently to that interview. He seemed to have a level of optimism that I found most encouraging.
Right.
And then guess what? He gets slapped around by Attorney General Abbott over child support?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I can certainly talk about that. And, you know, Anthony is still optimistic. But as with everything else in this case, nothing comes easy.
Okay. Give us some... tell us about Anthony. How did you get to know Anthony?
Well, I was kind of randomly assigned Anthony's case when my students and I were working along with David Dow at the University of Houston Law Center for the Texas Innocence Network. And my students volunteered to participate with Professor Dow, and so we were assigned some cases to investigate, and that's how we came across Anthony's case. So it was really kind of a matter of happenstance. But in looking at the case, it didn't take us very long to realize first that there was something really wrong with his conviction, and then second, to come to the personal conclusion that he was absolutely innocent of the crime. So that was back in the fall of 2002. So
2002, this is 2011.
Right. Well, it was about 8.5 years before anything happened, before he was released.
He got involved in the case due to misinformation from another person?
It's exactly right. The real killer was told by the Texas Rangers, if you give us another name, if you give us a name, we know you couldn't have done this by yourself. If you give us a name, we'll let you go. Of course, the Rangers were lying. But he, the real killer, Robert Carter, did provide a name. He gave the name of Anthony Graves. And he later said to anyone who would listen, pretty much, that he had pulled that name out of the air. Anthony was his wife, Robert's wife's first cousin, and Robert felt sure that he would have family members, girlfriend, who could provide him with an alibi, and so the case wouldn't be pursued against Anthony. But, of course, Robert was wrong about that.
The documentary found film in the booking office.
Yes, uh-huh.
Where Anthony was first informed that he was charged.
Yes.
And that impressed me as an amazingly telling stretch of video or film.
Yes, it was very moving. It was really one of the hardest things that I watched when Anthony was still on death row, because the man's innocence and bewilderment and befuddlement comes across so clearly in that video. He obviously has no idea why he's there at the police station. He thinks it's for a traffic ticket.
Nicole, this is Elizabeth Stein.
Yeah.
I've got a question for you. Now that Anthony has been out, what, about 6 months?
Right.
After 18 years behind bars, including 12 on death row, I'm wondering how his incarceration affected him, especially the extreme isolation that's experienced by prisoners on death row. Could
right.
you talk a little bit of how that is affecting him now that he's in the free world?
Sure, sure. You know, Anthony is an amazing person. He is incredibly resilient, and I have watched him myself very carefully because I was afraid there would be some lasting effects, and he seems to have escaped and remained quite healthy psychologically. Now, I know, though, that there are some lasting effects, and Anthony certainly can graphically describe the conditions that he endured on death row. One of the things that is so difficult to bear is being deprived of human company, being deprived of human contact, the noise level, the fact that other men surrounding cells may be suffering mental breakdowns. There's constant noise and screaming. Anthony was there when other inmates committed suicide, so he certainly has experienced some very bad things. One of the things that I was told back when I determined that Anthony was actually innocent, I was told actually by Professor Dow, there's no point in saving his life if he comes out crazy at the end. So one of the things that I really tried to do was to be sure that I visited Anthony, that I wrote to him, that and Anthony himself tried to keep in contact with the real world through listening to the radio and reading the newspaper. And he's very strong mentally, so he did not come out as scarred as I feared. One, I suppose, thing that I've noticed is that he needs to be alone from time to time. He enjoys being with other people, but he needs to pull back and have quiet time, alone time. And that's because he was so accustomed to being alone, being kept in those isolating conditions.
Professor, what kind of effect has this experience been on your students?
I think it's been a life-changing experience for the core team, the core group of students who stuck with me and gave me support and help through this entire ordeal. I think that this experience has changed their lives. I know that several of them decided to go to law school. Two have completed law school. Another one is getting ready to start law school. But they are they've all been touched by it. I think they're much more critical of the justice system. They are, they have their eyes open. They understand the importance of activism and standing up, for those who need our help.
And some of the students were actually tasked with keeping Anthony informed of the status of the case.
Well, whenever I would go and visit Anthony, I would try to take a student along, because every person who makes a trip to death row and sees that these are men who may have made mistakes, or they may be innocent, but they are human beings. And by going to death row, that's the only way to really experience that and see it for yourself.
Did you come to this as a novice yourself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had been working on investigating cases for maybe one semester before Anthony's case landed in our labs. So it's beginner's luck, I guess.
And the role of journalism generally in the truthfulness of and the veracity of the system?
Well, I think that journalism's job is to be a watchdog. If journalists aren't being a watchdog on government, on authority, then they aren't doing their jobs. And the skills that investigative journalists use are the same skills that investigators, criminal defense lawyers use in gathering evidence and checking out stories. So they got to practice their skills and use them for something that really made a difference in someone's life.
You know, Professor Casares, now that you mention investigators, that reminds me, when I met you a few months back when Anthony addressed a conference in Austin, and it was a very emotional moment, and he spoke to you and others at your table as if you were family members, and in fact, I could tell that he considers you as such. But a couple of folks he referred to who haven't mentioned were the investigators. Could you talk a little bit about them?
Well, sure. When Anthony was given a retrial, his conviction was overturned in 2006 by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then the state elected to pursue a retrial. At that point, Anthony's attorneys and I was on the legal team were able to get an investigator appointed. And once again, the investigator, Rick Ojeda, is a professional, a former FBI agent, and he went over all of the information that I had collected with my students, and he came quickly to the same conclusion, the conclusion everyone came to who seriously looked at the case, which is there's no way this man did it. And so Rick became another source of support for Anthony. And when a professional like that, when someone who, you know, was involved in law enforcement believes in you and gets on your team and helps follow up leads and come as in reports to you in jail, that Rick became a very strong source of support for Anthony, so he was very important.
And ultimately Kelly Siegler joined support for Anthony, which was no doubt a shock and a surprise to those of us who've seen her perform in Harris County Courthouse.
Well, it certainly was, but let me say this. Kelly Siegler put forth the kind of work and effort that this case needed. This case, There were 18 years basically worth of documents and record and hearing transcripts and witness interviews. She went through everything. She did the investigation that should have been done at the 1992.
Don't you think that's what a prosecutor is supposed to do in every case?
Every prosecutor in every case, but in my opinion, she's the one who. The only one who really took a serious look at this case, and then she came to the same conclusion that we all had as well. So my hat's off to her.
So when the shouting match came, it came between the special prosecutor and the original prosecutor in this case.
Well, the original prosecutor was the last to be. The original prosecutor. Yes. Well, he is unconvinced.
Amazing work. What's next?
We need to get Anthony his compensation.
Absolutely. And have you a plan?
Well, our plan has been to get a declaratory judgment from a court in Austin that Anthony is actually innocent. The reason he hasn't received his compensation is because that the dismissal order didn't contain those two words, actually innocent. So we're asking a court in Austin to give us a declaration that Anthony is actually innocent. And we, as the highest law enforcement officer of the state, we named the attorney general in the lawsuit, and the attorney general would agree that Anthony is actually innocent, and we could get a piece of paper stating that, then I think the comptroller would pay.
Nicole Casares, professor of journalism at the University of St. Thomas. Thank you very much for being on Execution
Watch.
Well, thank
you, Ray, for your interest in Anthony's case and your support.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Jim, it's back to us. You want to bring this other fellow in?
Yeah, there's one thing I'd like for... this is Larry Douglas. He's a kind of a baby lawyer that's bald-headed and older. He's baby in the sense he's now starting criminal law. He used to have, I think, worked in corporate work.
And so, isn't that kind of the poor end of the stick?
Extremely poor end of the stick. But Larry seems to be surviving. Last, he looks nicely. I have to call him every morning and tell him how to dress.
Larry, you're going to confess to being a criminal defense lawyer in practice. And let me tell you who's listening. About 12,000 convicts are listening to the show because we recently moved from the HD channel where I did a show for 30 years. And now we're over here in the broadcast channel, and we have a new repeater in Huntsville. So they are gathered up in the Walls and the Wind and the Goree at the Holiday, at the Bird. They're gathered up in the Ellis and the Estelle in solitary super segregation. Now, you're still going to admit being a lawyer here.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Not only admitted, but proud of it. Proud of it, Ray.
Something I want him to talk about, because Larry's probably never handled a capital murder case. And I've one of the real, real difficult things of handling capital murder cases is after the case is over with, the zealots, and there's nothing wrong with being a zealot, but the zealots don't pay much attention to truth. And that's on both sides. And although we're critical, Danny Sebesta, for example, Sebesta was that DA that handled that case for Graves. And everybody considers him, he's always been considered terribly unethical. But by the same token, I think that it hurts the death penalty movement a great deal. And we have people that come in after a conviction occurs and literally dreams up stuff. And I want Larry to comment on one of the criticisms that was levied against the lawyer when the lawyer's doing exactly what he wanted to do. And I'm talking about, Larry, that instance where they're criticizing the lawyer, saying, we don't have to prove anything, we don't have to. Would you explain that? And I want you to talk about something. You did some research on what different groups have said. I'm talking about pro-death penalty people. That makes people look somewhat foolish. Would you comment on that?
Well, yeah. The thing about capital murder cases, and I have not handled one before,
right,
they live forever. It just makes you wonder why anybody would ever want to do one, but I'm glad that people who do that, they do a great job. The thing is that when you start looking over people's shoulder and grading their papers and criticizing what they do, sometimes the criticisms are criticizing them for doing exactly what they should do. I saw one criticism that the lawyer had actually repeatedly told the jury that the lawyers didn't have to do anything except show up. That's really all they had to do. Well, the jury has to know that the burden of proof is solely on the state, and the defense never has to do anything. Now, that's not saying we'll never do anything.
Yeah,
but
sure,
to say we don't have to is really the lawyer's obligation to at least make sure that the jury knows the level of input that the lawyer has to have. Now, clearly, these lawyers did a great job. They did the best they could under the circumstances. Now, no matter how good a job you do, somebody can always find something wrong with it, and as it should be. If you do something wrong, somebody—it's okay to point that out. And many lawyers will willingly say, "Okay, yeah, maybe I messed that up, and I did that, messed it up too." But by the same token, it's not fair to criticize them for doing exactly what they should be doing.
And there were some more things you'd mentioned before. You'd read some of the sites that came up with facts that I didn't find in the record also. Is that also true?
There were a couple of sites that I looked at, because when you asked me to come down to Jim, I looked at not only the summaries, but also looked on the net, where there were some sites that pretty much were trying to make the argument of actual innocence. But in so doing, to do so, what they in essence did was focused on things that were just not part of the case.
But see, in this case, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't have done stuff on mitigation. That may or may not be true. I don't know. The problem is to evaluate where they were negligent, not presenting mitigating evidence, is none of them who complain about that and never tell us what the mitigating evidence is, so it's hard to evaluate it.
Right.
And their defensive theory probably was pretty sound, because he was offered a life sentence to begin with, and he turned it down. And you got some real problems, and a lot of it has nothing to do with the law. You got the psychological problem of another offense as almost a fingerprint of this offense or introduce a punishment. That's some compelling evidence. Plus, you've got the fact he leaves the bar at the moment, ends up dead. He's got her underwear and stuff in the apartment that's torn up. And their defensive theory, and they argued it vigorously, was the fact it was not a capital murder case, because it was a case of consensual sex and thereafter a murder. And even if he was the one that committed the murder, that wouldn't make it capital murder if they had consensual sex. And that was their defensive theory, what they tried to sell. And those things, to a Fort Worth jury, as Ray talked about earlier, that's kind of a hard sell to the jury, but that's what you've got. And I'm not saying the lawyer, I don't know much what the mitigating evidence they could have introduced. It's hard to evaluate them being negligent for not doing that.
Yeah, and where do you find substantial evidence of the existence of that mitigating evidence?
Exactly, and you don't know where it comes from, because here's one of the problems you got, Ray, and this is one of the problems that the people that take pot shots at lawyers that try these cases, one of the problem is they can read a statement that somebody gives, but they never see the person who gives the statement have a chance to evaluate them. For example, I had to call Robert Pelton, a guy that I dearly love, as a witness one time, and I didn't believe him myself, and he was telling the truth. He was the worst witness I've ever seen in my life.
Lawyers tend to do that.
And I mean, and so what happens when you read that this happened, you need to look at the vessel. Just because you can read, because you get a good piece of music, doesn't mean somebody can sing it who's tone deaf. I mean, you can get the greatest piece of poetry in the world, and some idiot who sounds like Donald Duck can't sing it. So a part of the problem is when they go out and say, you should have done this and should have done that, all they have in front of them are statements. And that's only a part of it, because you've got one of the things a lawyer has got to do is evaluate whether or not that person is believable, whether it helps you in front of the jury. And you can't do that by looking at a piece of paper any more than you can say, I can fall in love with a woman based on a resume. You don't know that.
I've got two lawyers in here. Put yourself in the situation of the criminal defense lawyer, and the DA has come and said, all right, I'm going to offer you life in prison for this case, and you know what we now know about the state of the evidence of the case. How do you handle that, Larry?
Well, it's more informing the client. Because it's the client's decision and solely his decision as to what to do. But you do have to explain to him what could happen to him in very certain terms. But in the final analysis, it's the client and only the client who makes that final decision.
How do you explain a good result here is in your imagination and not real? How do you do that?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understand that question.
Given the fact situation here, the evidence that you know the state's got, let's say there was reasonable discovery and this is not a trial by ambush, and you know that going in, and the state offers it, we'll give you a life sentence instead of going through this old capital trial. And you say, what are your chances here? How candid are you about what are your chances here?
Absolutely candid. Now the thing is, what we have to recognize as lawyers is that we really don't know what's going to happen. Now I know that the whole thing about the client being the one to decide is one that I've had in the time that I've practiced, have to take some lessons myself, because I've had clients that I was sure was going to get hurt real bad. And it wouldn't make any sense whatsoever to go to trial, but they wanted to go to trial anyway. And they've gotten some good results, because some of the things they told me that I really didn't believe, as it turns out, you know, when they say, well, this officer's lying through his teeth and this is going to come out. Well, I'm not sure about that. But it actually came out. And just to have the client look over at you and say, I told you so, by the same token, I've had clients who just sell me a bill of goods that I bought completely.
Selling hogs is not a new thing.
And I'm in the middle. I'm accepting this, and I'm really thinking we're doing a good job on the case. And he turns to me and says, I need to go ahead and plead because of what just came out. And I'm thinking, whoa, we went through all this.
Well, one thing I think just letting the client decide may be a cop-out. I don't think you're quite saying that. I think it's our job to lay out what the evidence is going to show.
Absolutely.
And then once we lay it out, say that this may or may not be true, but the evidence is going to say that. And in my opinion, if you try this from a jury, the odds are you're going to be convicted.
Absolutely.
And so one of the things you've got to look at when you evaluate a case like that, if you guess wrong, how bad's the punishment? For example, you got a habitual case with a 25-year minimum, and they're willing to reduce enhancement counts. Is it worth taking that gamble with the 25-year minimum? And something that I've done, and I'm a great, great believer in this, I'm a great believer when we sit down with a set of facts with a client is to have a woman present, because women can pick up on things that men don't pick up. Example, I've been helping a lawyer out in West Texas on a murder case. And I spent the entire weekend looking at video films of witnesses testifying, giving statements. And I was obsessed with what they were doing, this figuring out a defense based upon that, looking at the legal part of it. And when we finished, I had a lady lawyer with me, and I did it deliberately, taking a lady lawyer with me. And I said, what's your reaction? You know what she said? And it never dawned on me. They are so sleazy, a jury's going to convict them all because they're sleazy. And I began to think about that, and what she said was actually true. So part of what I had to do was try to figure out a way to separate the client from the sleaziness of the co-defendants that he was involved with, and come up with some sort of way, which meant, in this case, he had to testify. Because, for example, the way you get redemption, there are only two ways you get redemption in West Texas. That's getting born again, and Jerry Swaggart ruined that by going out on Telephone Road, New Orleans. And the other way is a good woman. So my theory was putting the man on the stand and looking that juror in the eye and said, I'm sorry that I got involved in all of this. Drugs and money ruined my head. I'm sorry this happened. And I've got my life changed. I met this good woman. And the only reason I did, I met this good woman who's got me getting straightened out, which, again, with the women are the ones that think it's sleazy, and that would appeal to them. So, again, you've got to sit down. And I'm a great believer when you discuss that with a case to have a woman there, because I talked about this a
lot. Well, it would take a woman to forgive Jimmy Swaggart, because I watched that whole film very closely.
And
it never occurred to me to think that he did anything right.
Well, I understand. But, see, the redemption you get is either being born again or meeting a good woman. Jerry Swaggart ruined that getting born again, because everybody remembers him, that sleaze bag. So,
all right, this is over.
Okay.
Carrie Kerr, age 46, a young man,
yep,
is now dead.
Right.
And to the very end, he insisted on his innocence. Regardless of what juries believe and regardless of what executioners do, Carrie Kerr believed, or would have us believe he believed, that he was innocent.
He took a different stance than the later writs, though, right?
He did?
Yeah. The stance in the writ with the Supreme Court is that he did it, but they didn't introduce mitigating punishment.
Okay.
So he kind of, I know that was
he
a lawyer.
Hedged the
I don't
bet.
Know whether it's a lawyer's talking or Carrie Kerr talking, but that was what was presented at the Supreme Court today.
Okay, but at the time they made him the offer, he insisted was innocent. And that's what we're here for. And we will be here again the next time there is an execution. This is not a pleasant show to do. And you fellers down on the wind farm and in the balds and in the Goree and the Bird, and you folks down on the Ramsey and the Darrington that are listening to the show tonight, you've heard my voice for 30 years. Try to give you some encouragement. But when I get on this show, I'm a different feller. And the reason I'm a different feller, because this is as serious as it gets. Mm-hmm. The state of Texas, strapped down, Carrie Kerr in a very ritualistic kind of way. And the warden was there, and the chaplain was there. And at some point, they gave a signal, and they started pouring chemicals in the body, and they watched their chest heave up and down until all of that stopped. And when they couldn't get a pulse in his neck, and the artery in his neck, he was pronounced dead. We don't know for sure whether he was dead or not because nobody comes back to tell us. The family, and there were only two family members or one family member in as a witness, came out of the witness stand, crossed the street, gathered up the stuff she had left in the waiting room, and rushed to the funeral home to feel of him while his body was still warm. Sometimes, whether we do something or not, the impact on the rest of us means we need to give that another thought. To those of you who are headed in a wrong direction, to those of you who are going to get as drunk as Carrie or his victim, let me encourage you to think seriously about what alcohol is doing to you and your brain. My name is Ray Hill. You've been listening to Execution Watch. I appreciate you being in the audience. You can always let me know what you think by emailing ray@therayhill.com, or I'll see you when you get out, son.